So this is about building a recipe, and what Steve just showed us that we're pretty convinced wherever we look, if we add wood chips to the soil, we can capture more rainfall and maintain higher soil moisture. So wood chips are a piece of the puzzle. But we know there are other ingredients. We need some other things. So that's what Steve left us with. And in this soil, it's 92% sand. It has a bulk density of about 1.5, about 1 to 2% organic matter. pH is 9. It's really low in nutrients. I mean, it's just almost pure sand. Obviously, we need other things, all right? Wood chips alone are not going to be enough. And what are those ingredients, all right? Chagan did a great job for his dissertation. What he did, this is just one of the sets of experiments he did, and when he does something, he's meticulous, does tons of replication, and he actually compared whole suites of different kinds of materials that were available in nature to look at, one, what the physical properties would be from adding those to the soil, and then whether or not you could grow something in it. And what you have over there is the list, like the twigs and mulch are things that were on the surface, just the surface of the sandy soil. Chips are where we put the popular chips into the soil at different amounts, 2%, 5%, 8%, 11%, more and more chips, with or without twigs on the surface. And then he tried locust, elm, rape, and then what most people add are manure, rice, and wheat. So we're going to try it all. In the first part of this experiment, using these pots, he just had no plants growing in them for 3 months. He watered them approximately once every 10 days and looked at the physical properties of the system over time. And then he added fertilizer because it's so nutrient poor. We've tried growing like some grasses out there, nothing happened. So he said, let's add some fertilizer to it, keep the water at a constant amount, and add wheat seeds to it and see if they grow. And that's just some of the photographs of the different types of woody material. And this looks similar to what Steve showed you. There's the surface mulch. There's the twigs on the surface. This is with chips incorporated. This is getting the manure incorporated all the way through the column. So this is all those treatments. But the main thing, and this is the bulk density, total porosity, water holding capacity, they were all significantly different. All right? And the important one to note, here's control twigs mulch. That's where you're putting something on the surface or nothing at all. So the soil itself all has very high bulk density. As soon as you start adding, not surprisingly, lighter organic materials into the soil, you start to lighten the soil up. If you increase it from 2% to 5% more, you're decreasing the bulk density more and more. And this is with the other materials. And so depending on what material you add, you can improve the soil's bulk density. Not surprising, but good to see. And that translates, just as Steve showed you, into water retention properties. And so the same, controlled tweaks and mulch have the least water holding capacity. And as we increase the amount of organic matter added, we can increase its ability to hold water. He then grew the wheat, and this is, you don't have to look at all these, but he looked at photosynthesis, the SVAD, plant height, biomass, compared all of them. And not surprisingly, or the exciting part, there was a big difference. There's a control down there. So this is what the farmers are growing in China right now, okay, in this region. And all we do is add wood chips, and what we can do is we can increase the amount of wheat yield. This is great. Elm, populus, and locust did really well. Manure did not. Rice didn't do too well. Wheat straw did better than we expected, but we're not sure how comparable the quantities added were. But basically, if you add fertilizer, you add wood chips, you can improve soil moisture properties and increase plant growth. We don't know once we start saying we're going to add nutrients, well, how much do you add? And what happens to, does it leach out the bottom? Do we have greenhouse gas emissions? So there's this whole issue of, okay, now we're going to start fertilizing these soils. Aaron Menzies here is now a PhD candidate at Cornell in the Department of Environmental Engineering, and that's the basis of her dissertation. And so she's been working on column studies all summer and into the fall, looking at, all right, well, what leaches out the bottom? How much, you know, you have wood chips in there, what's coming out? Do we have greenhouse gas emissions? How much fertilizer should we add? I mean, this is a recipe, guys. We're working with pure sand and trying to turn it into a living, healthy soil. So stay tuned. She'll be presenting her work maybe next year of what she finds out. She's seeing some exciting things. But there are other recipe ingredients. This is the one I'm very excited about. Wood is not all the same. Wood actually varies a lot in how quickly it decomposes. Now, we all know, if anybody burns with wood, If you burn pine, it's really fast. If you burn like with oak, it's longer, it's hotter, and locust burns really hard and hot, okay? Woods have different properties. Same thing like building a house. They also decompose at different rates. And so there are plant materials that really disappear quickly. Leaves, grasses, some grasses, algae, all right? You put them in the soil, they're gone in a week, all right? There are many of those woods that last about 5 to 10 years. So populus falls in that category. White oak, tulip poplar, hickory, last about 5 to 10 years. And our wood chip study that we set up in 2011, each year we've gone back, and this summer I said, guys, these wood chips are almost gone. We basically either have to reset up this experiment or think about, because we're not growing grasses there, so the wood is slowly decomposing. But what's really cool is there's a lot of woods that last very long. And the one I'm most interested in that we've been talking about a ton is black locust, Robinia pseudoacacia. If you're a farmer of New York, everybody knows, you want to put in fence posts, you put in black locusts. They'll be there 80 to 100 years. And so the question is, this big issue of carbon sequestration. We have a terrible problem getting rid of a lot of CO2, all right? Now, biochar is really cool because it's being used in tropical areas to enrich the soils. It's basically like a kind of charcoal, doesn't almost ever decompose, and it's really great for soils. But you have to cook it, so you have to use energy to make it, and it puts out CO2. So, but that's not true with black locusts. And so right now, this recent study that just came out from Dr. Lau and his chambers, which is saying we have the potential to sequester a lot of carbon in our soils. And what we argue is, yeah, if we restore soils, but include a range of types of wood chips, including some that are very slowly decomposing, we can actually start to put in a lot of carbon underground. So for the past year, we've been trying different experiments. One, we work with undergrads doing projects. We did some soil respiration experiments for populus versus locust to see, does this make sense? Is this really happening? This is the town for sure. This is microbial respiration from soils from North Dakota we brought back. This is a soil unamended, that's the microbial respiration rate using these static chamber techniques. This is when we add wood chips of populus with and without a fertilizer, nitrate fertilizer. And here's locusts, same at the same concentrations, definitely decomposing slower. Dr. David Weinstein is building us a model to try and quantify how much carbon sequestration could we accomplish using this. But from the, and that's meaning once you get grasses up and running, because most of the thinking about carbon sequestration is taken into account, we're going to start growing grasses there. And grasses sequester carbon underground, they grow roots, build up those nice deep organic soils. So we're saying if you have a capital investment of 10% wood chips, volume to volume, you are storing 17,000 kilograms of carbon per hectare. That takes 20 trees per hectare, all right, at 50 centimeters dBH. It's a cheap investment, one time, that you can sequester carbon. And if it's half populus and half locust, half of it will still be there 80 years from now. So we're really excited by this piece of, guys, here's a whole other benefit, independent of water, saving water, reducing irrigation, getting life going, we can sequester carbon. There's another piece. What are we going to grow? And so we know growing food is the big issue. But there's a reason that grasses are growing in these semi-arid regions. Grasses. Think about it, you know? This big canopy, you know, waving fields of grain, all these stems all close together. Why? What makes that? That's an unusual growth form, these long stems densely packed. Well, we started doing some work on condensation. How important is condensation? When you hear about rain, how much water a plain community has, it's always how much rainfall there is a year, occasionally how much per growing season. We wanted to look at condensation because here's this weird kind of canopy, and we said, how much water can condense on grasses? What's the source? Is it captured or is it stored underground? We started with a simple experiment, and we're just getting going, but we did this experiment where we set up two species of prairie grass, Panicum verbatim, and then an invasive one, Panicetum. We set up controls that had no grass. Condensation was allowed in a set of them to grow in a field. And then some were not allowed to condense. They had a lid on at night, so no condensation could occur. And it was a weighing lysimeter technique, so we weighed them at night to see how much they had lost during the day, changed their weight, right, because evaporation, they lose weight. Transpiration, they get lighter. But overnight, if they condense, they get heavier, right? So in the morning, we would re-weigh them. We took a bunch of other measurements on volumetric soil moisture content so we could look at how much water was in the soil, monitored a bunch of microclimatic data, and then determined the plant biomass and surface area. And in a nutshell, it's this. Here's the controls. That is just soil in a pot, and basically, sure, every day you evaporate water. That's the average and the standard deviation of how much water gets evaporated every day over about an 18-day cycle. And at night, a little bit of water condenses, all right? In the plant pots, they evaporate and transpire a lot of water during the day, but every night they condense water back on the foliage. They gain weight at night. The plants with the lids on at night do the same thing during the day as their counterparts who, because during the day nobody has lids and they all lose evaporated transpired water, but at night they lose water. That means they're not allowed to condense water and they actually lose water. So they're not able to collect water from the atmosphere, whereas these guys do. On average, these plants are capturing 23% of the water they lose in transpiration every day. That's a lot of water. We evaluated how that fit into the soil. So this is, they dry out, and then we had to add water to the plant to start to wilt. So we add water back to the pots, watch them dry out again, a third drying cycle, and measure them at night and again in the morning. So this is nighttime volumetric water content, daily water content over the cycle. And what you're seeing is they start at the same soil moisture content, but after the first cycle, those with the lids on are drier, so the soils are drying out. All right. Now, some people have said that condensation helps plants stay more turgid. So one thing they do is absorb the water, it doesn't show up in the soil. We think actually it's also rolling down the stems, ending up in the soil, and keeping the volumetric water content a little bit wetter, a little bit longer, sometimes they get to that next rainfall. So a key issue is what is the amount of rainfall and how often does it occur? And that's what we became aware of in Ningxia. It was like, wow, looking at a 12-year record, it's like 5 millimeters occur once every 5 days. You get about a centimeter every 10 days. These are, it's very small amounts of water, but it's not no water. And if you condense water, and also it reduces evaporation as well, so the stems actually reduce evaporation from, so you don't lose as much, it keeps you going till the next rainfall. We looked at our biomass, and it was comparable to some of the reports for what are in prairies. Our condensation rates were very comparable to what other people said. One study said in a very, like a long, the condensation represented 2 to 4% of the annual budget. Another study showed it could be up to like 25 to 30%, depending on how dry the year is. And so there's not a lot done. I could talk to you a lot about condensation. This is something I'm very excited about. It's an ecological process. Evapotranspiration is about 700 millimeters per season. It's a ton of water. And depending on where you are in the prairies, you're either getting 150 up to 700 millimeters of rainfall. So a big deficit. Condensation can be 10 to 20% or more, keeping you going until that next rain event. The soil is allowing water to go down to the soil, so the soil then stores it. There is some internal distillation, so the water may evaporate but then run back down the stem. It's a way to keep the water in the system. We are starting to see data that it reduces evaporative loss. And so it kind of seems to be to us that really a grassland is like a living system both above ground and below ground. The grasses make the organic matter. It's like a carpet or a fur across the landscape. When it's intact, it's perfectly designed to capture rainfall and dew and keep it in the system through dry periods. All right, that would mean we really kind of need to get the grasses growing again, okay? It's not really sustainable in other systems. So we started some experiments actually this past year. It set up in 2015 in these large tanks growing grasses. We irrigated them to get them started, but we're looking at now comparing grasses with and without quincers. Get going, because you got to get them going. And we were starting to see that there's definitely improvement in grass growth if we have amended soils. So it is possible. But what do we talk to the farmers about, the ranchers? Because, again, we need food for people. And some places, and that's why we want feedback. Will people be happy saying, what if we go to perennial grains? All right, that'll do this. You know, that'll help with the condensation. What about limited grazing? What about biofuel production for switchgrass? Does switchgrass a native grass species? All of those systems could probably be developed to be non-irrigating. So right this summer, we have a field of switchgrass being grown for biofuels. It's 4 years old. It's about 1.5 to 2 meters tall. Our area had the worst drought it's ever had, so it's almost comparable to New York. There was like a 12-inch water deficit between April and September, which means we normally have 3 inches a month, and we had none, didn't rain, and the grass grew perfectly. There was no impact whatsoever on yield, and we're monitoring condensation, and it's like, there it is, it's catching water. Okay, and so that's more of the ingredients. That's kind of the overview of the ingredients. So what we're going to do, take a minute, shake yourself out, stand up, sit down, because we have two more presentations.